It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting the latest Ukrainian ceasefire appears to be in jeopardy. Pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine are reportedly massing near the port city Mariupol and continue attacking government positions despite a multinational ceasefire reached early this month in Belarus. The rebels Monday consolidated their hold on the town of Debaltseve after Ukrainian forces withdrew. Jen Psaki is a U.S. State Department spokesperson.
Russia and the separatists are only complying in a few areas selectively, not in Debaltseve, not outside of Mariupol, not in other key strategic areas. This is clearly unacceptable. We have a range of options that remain on the table if this failure continues.
At the UN Security Council in New York, Ukraine's foreign minister pleaded for peacekeepers, Pavlo Klimkin, accusing Moscow and its separatist supporters of ignoring the ceasefire. Kenya's constitutional court threw out part of the country's new anti-terror law Monday, including restrictions on the media. The court ruled state restrictions on the media reporting on security operations limited the right of free expression and violated the country's constitution. Justice Isaac Leniola.
Section 12 of the Security Laws Amendment Act and Section 66 of the Penal Code is hereby declared unconstitutional for violating the freedom of expression in the media guaranteed under Articles 33 and 34 of the Constitution. Section 64 of the Act, which introduced Section 30 of the Prevention of Terrorism Act, is also declared unconstitutional for the same reasons.
The court also overturned a cap on the number of refugees allowed into Kenya and said authorities could detain suspected terrorists for 360 days rather than 90 without charging them. The government says it may appeal. This is VOA News. The United States and Iran reported they made some progress Monday in the latest round of negotiations on Tehran's nuclear program, but said that a deal is still a long way off. Josh Earnest is a White House spokesman.
Our odds of reaching an agreement with Iran are 50-50 at best. I think that continues to be a fair assessment of where things stand. A lot of this, again, rests on the commitment of Iranian hardliners to move forward with an agreement that would resolve the international community's concerns.
Both sides describe the second day of talks in Geneva between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif as serious, useful, and constructive. They're trying to meet a self-imposed March 31 deadline to reach a framework accord with a July 1st deadline for a permanent agreement that would ensure Iran's nuclear activities are peaceful in exchange for lifting Western economic sanctions. Greece slid past its Monday deadline to hand an economic reform proposals over to its European creditors, but said it would finish them Tuesday morning as part of an agreement to extend a bailout for 4 months. European finance ministers are awaiting proposals from Athens' new leftist government to convince the country's creditors to grant the extension. Stefan Kampeter is a German deputy finance minister.
I would say the last 3 weeks were not improving the trust in the Greek authorities by many in Europe. But being a long-time politician, I know you don't have to look always back. Look forward. Try whether they can deliver positive, whether they stuck to their proposals. It is a question whether we can drive the process into the right direction where trust can grow on all sides.
The proposals are aimed at reviving the country's faltering economy and cut government spending in exchange for renewing the more than $270 billion in loans. Former Ivorian First Lady Simone Gbagbo has rejected charges of rebellion and xenophobia in her first public statements at an Abidjan trial over her role in post-election violence in 2010. She's among more than 80 from her husband's administration accused of crimes against humanity. Some 3,000 were killed in the wake of the contested election. An Egyptian court sentenced prominent activist Ala Abdel Fattah to 5 years in prison Monday on charges connected to a law banning protests. Authorities said in November 2013, Abdel Fattah incited an unauthorized demonstration and assaulted a police officer. The Cairo court also sentenced 24 others to between 3 and 15 years. The families of all three British schoolgirls believed to be heading to Syria via Turkey to join Islamist fighters issued desperate pleas for them to return home. The girls' friends from the same London school disappeared Tuesday without leaving messages. Turkish police have joined forces with their British counterparts to search for the girls. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 24th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's Boko Haram militants shift to guerrilla warfare as military pressure mounts.
Now they're going to activate cells in cities and attempt to shoot at cities and continue the war, but not in occupying territories and not in being very defensive.
That's defense security analyst Al-Kassim Adukadir. Zimbabwe appeals for debt cancellation from the African Development Bank. Libya's internationally recognized government pulls out of peace talks. And South Sudan's peace talks finally got underway Monday with a warning to make progress this time around.
This is a final opportunity to make progress and usher in a new era of peace in South Sudan. We must not fail.
Seyoum Men's Film is IGAD's chief mediator. New South Sudan fighting sends a surge of refugees to Sudan's border, and Sierra Leone quarantines 20 children at an orphanage after a staff member is diagnosed with Ebola. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. As multinational forces and the Nigerian military make inroads against Boko Haram in Nigeria's northeast, the militant group has been staging attacks outside its usual areas of strength. As Chris Stein reports from Abuja, experts say this may be a sign of a shift in the group's tactics.
Boko Haram's attack on the city of Gombe earlier in February came as a surprise to many. The fighters reached the heart of the city, fired on soldiers, and distributed leaflets warning against voting in the March 28th presidential election. Boko Haram has carried out bombings in Gombe, but the attack was unusual. A resident of the town of Dadinkoa, which was also attacked by the insurgents, says the incursion seemed less an attempt to occupy territory than to simply spread fear.
Yeah, I think their aim was to scare people inside the Gombe town because they distributed leaflets. Because they entered right into the heart of the town, even the around the military barrack area.
During the past weeks, a renewed offensive by the Nigerian military and troops from neighboring Chad, Cameroon, and Niger has put pressure on Boko Haram. Nigeria's military says it has recaptured a string of towns from the militants, including Baga, where the extremists overran a military base and carried out a massacre last month. Freelance journalist and security analyst Al-Kassim Abdul-Kadir says the military gains are forcing Boko Haram to change tactics.
If the offensive gets more intensive, then we'll see them looking for new frontiers to wage their war.
He expects a resurgence of bomb and suicide attacks as Boko Haram is pushed out of their strongholds in the northeast.
Now they're going to activate cells in cities and attempt to hit at cities and continue the war, but not in occupying territories and not in being very defensive. You know, they're going to go underground and there'll just be a motley of armed insurgents fighting in some chosen areas, you know. But I believe that the attack is going to continue more with suicide bombings and also attack on urban populations.
Imam Dauda Bello, a member of the Interfaith Adamawa Peace Initiative, says he believes the fighters are trying to reach cities.
They were trying to get across to Cameroon and other places, but now Cameroon is attacking them also. So they cannot go to Cameroon, they cannot go to Niger, and they cannot go back to Chad.
The fear of infiltrators is hitting camps for internally displaced people particularly hard, Bello says. Administrators are now dealing with allegations that people who seek refuge in the camps are members of the group. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
More than 20 children have been quarantined at an orphanage in Sierra Leone after one of the staff members was diagnosed with Ebola. Tina Davis is the pillar lead for child protection, gender, and psychosocial with Sierra Leone's National Ebola Response Center. She says there's no cause for alarm as everything is under control at the orphanage.
One of the social workers proven positive of EVD, which is the Ebola virus disease, and as a preventative measure, because he was at the orphanage at a meeting last Wednesday. So we thought to actually line list these children and make sure that they are not in and out if there is any transmission, ensuring that it's been contained within that environment.
Is there anyone in that orphanage that has contracted the disease?
No, no one that lives within that. It's just a worker that's shown positive. But he doesn't live there. He comes and goes. But in terms of the children themselves and other work colleagues, nobody's exhibited any signs or symptoms at the moment.
And how long is the quarantine supposed to last?
21 days.
You said the entire staff will have to go under the 21-day quarantine?
21-day quarantine, all those who've had contact with him.
The other day, the government was going door to door to find out whether there were some dead bodies, Ebola dead bodies. How is it going? Was that a successful program?
It is successful, but just to state that most of the dead bodies in the community are not EVD positive, which is a good thing, meaning that our line listing and our surveillance has been quite robust. A lot improved as opposed to like a month ago, wherein you'll be having like 7% or up to 12% of corpses proving positive of EVD. So most of them now that have been swabbed, they're negative. Although it was 1%, it's gone to 3%, but not significant rise.
How would you assess now the Sierra Leone government's, the effort to control the virus in Sierra Leone? Would you say that the numbers are decreasing or are they still the same or what?
Well, the numbers are decreasing, although there are times because of a sort of outburst in certain areas, it's going up. But then people who've understood the trend of Ebola, it's going through its normal kind of bumpy ride, as you say, ups and downs, until it would have. I know a few days we were going on single digits, but now it's going to double us. But then it's basically between 10 and 20 at the moment.
You know, schools are supposed to open in Sierra Leone. I think that's next week. That's March 2nd. How prepared are your people?
Well, that was the plan. But as we go into the decontamination of schools that were used for holding centers and stuff like that, ongoing, but not quite completed. So I'm sure the government will have to review that to see whether it is visible for schools to reopen this March or whether they have to extend it.
Tina Davis is the pillar lead for Child Protection, Gender and Psychosocial with Sierra Leone's National Ebola Response Center. She is speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. Libya's internationally recognized parliament, based in Tobruk, voted on Monday to pull out of UN-sponsored national dialogue talks with a rival government based in Tripoli. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
The vote to suspend participation in the UN-sponsored dialogue talks came as emotions continue to run high after last week's car bomb attacks in the eastern city of Quba, which killed over several dozen civilians. The town is the home of Parliament Speaker Akila Sala. Member of Parliament Omar Gaith says that lawmakers have summoned their delegation to the talks in the Moroccan capital Rabat, due to have been held on Thursday, to return to Tobruk for consultations. He says that the decision to suspend participation in the talks does not mean Parliament intends to boycott them, but that the climate isn't ripe for dialogue following a series of events, including the killings of 21 Egyptian Christians, the car bombings in Cuba, which left 55 dead, and given that the other side is not, in his view, serious about talks. At the same time, in the capital, Tripoli, which is under the control of the Islamist Fajr Militia Coalition, members of a national dialogue committee under the auspices of the old Legislative Assembly, the General National Congress, met to discuss the issues under consideration. Moussa Bigarash, spokesman for the committee, told Qatar-based Libya Likul al-Ahrar TV that the Libyan people are demanding a suspension of hostilities and talks. He says that given the recent violent turn of events in Libya, the time has now come for a national dialogue, and Libyan public opinion in its entirety would like to see a suspension of violence and the start of talks. U.S. Ambassador to Libya Deborah Jones tweeted that the U.S. has expressed no preference regarding a national unity government in Libya, except that it be representative and inclusive. Libya currently has two rival governments in the east and west of the country, although only the Abdullah Thani cabinet under the aegis of the parliament in Tobruk is internationally recognized. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 24th, and still to come, Mark Oldman's Post and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe has appealed for debt cancellation from the African Development Bank. Thomas Chiripasi has details from the Zimbabwe capital, Harare.
Minister Chinamasa met a 10-member delegation of the AFDB executive that is on a week-long visit in Harare and appealed for debt relief from the financial institution. He said if the AFDB cancels Zimbabwe's $500 million debt, other international money lending institutions were most likely to follow suit, adding this would help revive the country's struggling economy.
Because of their rules and regulations, we cannot enjoy the benefits of our membership, meaning we cannot access concessional borrowing from them unless we clear our arrears. So I've tried to appeal to the bank to come up with a mechanism that will help us clear those arrears. I'm aware that they've done it with respect to other countries, and my appeal to them is that they should bend over backwards to assist us so that we become part of the global economy.
FDB Executive Director and Head of the Bank's Zimbabwe Mission, Aliu Momodungum, would not say whether his institute would consider Zimbabwe's request for debt relief.
Our assistance to the country is not only to the public sector through government. We also very aware that really to accelerate the advancement of the country, we need to address the private sector.
The Harare administration has an external debt overhang of nearly $10 billion that the country has been failing to service. The AFDB delegation is expected to meet President Robert Mugabe before heading to Mozambique. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
South Sudan's peace talks, which were supposed to have begun on Friday last week, got underway yesterday, Monday, in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Lucy Pony of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports.
Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD chief mediator, Seyoum Mesfin, had a warning for all sides.
This is a final opportunity to make progress and usher in a new era of peace in South Sudan. We must not fail. After months of negotiations, you are all well aware of what must be achieved now. Genuine compromise and dialogue must take place.
The two sides have 10 more days to come up with a peace deal. The African Union and IGAD have repeatedly threatened the warring parties with sanctions if the fighting does not end and a comprehensive peace agreement is not reached by March 5th. Delegates from the government and the SPLM in opposition have assured IGAD mediators they will work to end the more than one-year-long conflict. Meanwhile, women activists and faith-based groups in Addis are demanding that President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar end the war immediately and sign a peace deal. Anglican Bishop Enoch Tombe told delegates at the opening of the talks that the South Sudanese people have suffered enough. He says leaders of the ruling SPLM must resolve their differences and put an end to the violence.
This final session is coming after the signing of the Arusha Agreement for reunification of the divided ruling party, the Sudan People Liberation Movement. The agreement, among other things, has given a lot of hope to the suffering people of South Sudan that at long last, the leaders of SPLM have come to realize the need to resolve their differences peacefully instead of through violence.
An SPLM in opposition delegate at the talks renewed his group's commitment toward ending the conflict through peaceful means. Diu Mathok says his group is committed to resolving the remaining issues.
The SPLM-SPLA delegation has come back to Addis Ababa fully aware of the enormous suffering of our people, the dire condition of our people, and the impending humanitarian catastrophe impel us to seek peace.
The delegates are expected to continue to discuss the issues of a permanent ceasefire, security, and power sharing at the talks in Addis. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
Fighting in the war-torn Numba Mountains in Sudan has led to an increase in the number of Sudanese refugees fleeing to South Sudan in the last month. In addition to an estimated 1.4 million internally displaced people, South Sudan is also now home to around 250,000 Sudanese. Adam Bales reports from Yeda, where more than 80,000 of them have taken refuge.
Yeda Camp in South Sudan's Unity State, one of the country's biggest refugee settlements. Everyone here has fled from a single conflict across the border in Sudan's South Kordofan state. UN officials say there has been a rapid rise in numbers arriving because of recent heavy clashes.
We have seen almost 100% increase in the last month when compared to the same period in 2013-2014, meaning almost 700 to 900 people every week coming to South Sudan.
A bloody civil war has raged for more than 3 years in Sudan's Nuba Mountains, with yearly fighting between Sudan government forces and Sudan's People's Liberation Army North rebels. The spreading ground fighting, intensified bombing by government planes and poor food security forced thousands of families to flee. Nearly 70% of new arrivals are children. This graffiti shows the land they left.
The Antonov planes come during the day and at night, too.
The planes bomb people everywhere. Whether you run or not, they bombard and kill you either way. We had neighbors who were hiding indoors one time when an Antonov came, but their house was bombed and they were killed.
People arrive with only what they can carry. Jalila Abraham arrived today. She says it took her 1 week to walk here from her village with her three children.
We came here because they continue to bombard us day and night. That is why we ran away.
Many new arrivals will travel to Ajon Thok, a UN camp to the east. But with a capacity for only 25,000 people, it is almost full. While Sudan's government denies it, Yida camp director Jacob Osman Kaluka says the bombing is intentionally driving civilians out of South Kordofan.
Their objective is to scare the people and to let them run away from the SPLA control area. That one, by burning all the crops in their fields, burning their houses, and giving them no rest.
Life in Yida camp is basic, but safe. Meanwhile, UNHCR says another new camp will soon be established to prepare for a surge of refugees expected from across the border in the coming months. Adam Bales for VOA News, Yida Refugee Camp, Unity State, South Sudan.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Egypt has withdrawn their bid to stage the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The Egyptian sports minister Khalid Abdel Aziz told the media in Cairo on Monday. Instead, he disclosed that Egypt will support Algeria's bid to stage the event. Supporting this position, the Egypt Football Association head Hani Abu Rida says there is no sense in two Arab countries competing against each other to host the Nations Cup. Egypt's exit leaves Algeria, Gabon, and Ghana vying to stage the 2017 Nations Cup after Libya, the designated hosts for the event, withdrew owing to the precarious security situation in the country. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, will name the successful bid in April. Some observers reckon that the recent suspension of the Egyptian Premier League may have also influenced Egypt's decision. 19 fans died during clashes between police and football fans in a stadium stampede in Cairo during a match between Zamalek and ENPPI. Meanwhile, Sudan edged hosts Ethiopia 2-1 in their men's 2015 All-Africa Games qualifiers in Addis Ababa on Sunday. Elsewhere, Nigeria beat Gabon 4-1, Burundi pipped the Democratic Republic of Congo 1-0, as Uganda and Mozambique drew 0-0. Elsewhere, visitors Botswana surprised their hosts Madagascar 3-1. In the opening leg of their women's 2015 All-Africa Games qualifier in the capital Antananarivo on Sunday, while Mali has advanced to the next round of the qualifiers after their opponents Gabon withdrew from the contest. Meanwhile, Mauritius outplayed their hosts Mozambique 5-2 in the return leg of their Africa Beach Soccer qualifier in Maputo on Sunday. Mauritius prevailed with a 9-4 aggregate. Hosts Tanzania pipped Kenya 7-6 in Dar es Salaam to advance to the next stage, courtesy of a 12-9 aggregate. In cycling, Tunisian Rafa Chitawi won the 127-kilometer Tour of Gabon cycling race that ended in the Gabonese capital Libreville on Sunday. Finally, in cricket, Zimbabwe play West Indies at the ICC Cricket World Cup in the Australian capital Canberra today, Tuesday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Monk. Have a good day. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 24. On this day, 1864, Rebecca Lee became the first black woman to receive a degree as a medical doctor. Also on this day, 1867, Howard University in Washington, D.C. was created by Congress. On this day, 1940, former world heavyweight boxing champion Jimmy Ellis was born, James Albert Ellis, in Louisville, Kentucky. Ellis won the World Boxing Association title after beating Derek Quarry in April of 1968. Did you know that Douglas L. Wilder was the first black to be elected governor in the United States since Reconstruction? In 1989, Wilder was elected governor of the state of Virginia. On this day in African history, 1966, Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana, was removed by the military. He was out of the country on a peace mission to Vietnam in Southeast Asia. Also on this day in African history, 1961, Dr. Louis Leakey discovered human-like bones in the old Dubai Gorge in Tanganyika, which is today Tanzania. The bones are believed to be the ancestors of modern man. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 24th. Congratulations to Chinedu Ona, care of the University of Nigeria at Nsukka in Enugu State, Nigeria, Richard Abiyewebi of Iforum in Delta State, Nigeria, and Kush Weti of Red Hill, Durban, South Africa. You are the winners of our February 23rd question. Which 19th century inventor is considered the Black Thomas Edison? The answer, Granville T. Woods. Now here is our question for today, February 24th. Which African-American civil rights activist and pan-Africanist was one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of the Colored People, or the NAACP? Once again, which African-American civil rights activist and pan-Africanist was one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of the Colored People, known as NAACP? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. That's it for this Tuesday, February 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer James Harmon, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good day.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 1730 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
voaafrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world.
You want it? We have it on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.